Francesca and I have been interested in a while in when issues get government attention, and what we're particularly concerned about is how hard it is for new issues like gender equality to get the attention of governments. Governments are focused on the core issues, on the economy, on foreign policy or defence, the core issues of government, and they only have limited attention to actually look beyond that and take on new issues. So we were interested in gender equality as an example of a new policy issue or a new set of policy issues that come onto the agenda, and we wanted to know why. I mean, it's very difficult, but actually we have evidence that over the last 30, 40 years, gender equality policy has reached government agenda, either through the second wave feminism, but also particularly under new Labour governments. Francesca and I led a project with our colleague Kirsten Rummery on women in New Labour, and we looked at examples in different policy areas of when and how New Labour governments acted for women and promoted gender equality. So it is possible for issues to get on the agenda, but it's difficult. And then there was this moment when the recession hit, when the recession bit in this country, when all of a sudden all of the commitments to gender equality started being backpedaled, and there were statements about how equal pay was too much in a time of recession. There were statements from Peter Mandelson about progress in parental leave, rolling out parental leave as well. So we had this hunch that actually maybe it's to do with economics. Maybe you could only get gender equality policy on the agenda when the economy is performing well. But maybe other kinds of gender equality policy, so to do with women's representation or women's bodily integrity, might get on the agenda at different times. And so what we wanted to do was test this empirically, both for the UK and then to look comparatively as well. So the plan for this session is to present and reflect on some of the findings that that we came up to relating to this, and we're really privileged to have the insight from two experts who have particular experience from the inside. So we're going to draw on their experiences as well. First of all, Kate Green is MP for Urmston and Stretford here in Manchester. She was elected in 2010. And she's also the shadow spokesperson for women and equalities. So, but before she was elected MP, she was the chief executive of the Child Poverty Action Group, and before that, director of One Parent Families, which is now Gingerbread. So Kate has, you know, the insight of a policy advocate both, you know, in Parliament and in advocacy groups outside of Parliament. So we're going to have some expert intervention there. Patrick is currently a research fellow in politics department here at Manchester with Francesca and I, but before he came to Manchester, he had a decade of experience as a special advisor and has worked in some of the most important, you know, offices of state. He's worked in Number 10 as a senior policy advisor to the Prime Minister, but also worked in the Cabinet Office, in the Northern Ireland Office, and also in the Equality and Human Rights Commission as the Group Director of Policy. So from Patrick, we're going to get some expert insights into how policy issues get on the get the attention of the Prime Minister or maybe the Treasury, but also what the Equalities and Human Rights Commission can do. So at this point, I'm going to pass over to Francesca, who's just going to outline, as I said, the key findings of the research that we did.
Well, as I'll try and be very brief. As Claire said, in 2008, as the financial crisis evolved, that made us question how much austerity might drive out some of the gender policy reforms that we'd seen coming through in the earlier New Labour years, and particularly those gender equality policies directed at addressing gender discrimination in the labour market and in the balance of paid and unpaid work, because these are costly policies. They're costly because they're redistributive. Policies to encourage women to stay in the labour market, like maternity leave, childcare, better pensions, or policies to encourage men to take on more of the unpaid caring roles are costly, and those costs fall on governments and employers and families. So to investigate this, we were really fortunate in that at Manchester at the time, a research group called the Policy Agendas, the UK Policy Agendas Project, was part of a bigger, wider federation of research projects across the US and Europe, was coding all kinds of government information according to a policy topic code book. And that means now in the UK, we can look at all kinds of different policy areas and see when they're reaching government agendas across policy areas, across time and across countries. So Claire and I searched for when these costly gender equality policies had reached the UK government agenda. And we looked at Queen's speeches, because that's a sure sign that government's really seriously thinking about doing something. And our hunch was that when the economy was shrinking, it would be harder for actors in the core executive to make the case to introduce these new costly reforms. And we found 15 times when these kinds of policies were mentioned in the Queen's speech since the Second World War. And when we looked at whether the economy was shrinking or expanding, sure enough, in all but two occasions we found that these measures were introduced when the economy was growing. And we went on to look at the second reading debates, and we could see in the argumentation coming forward from ministers, both Labour and Conservative, that, well, it was Labour ministers who were using equality arguments more forcefully, but every minister had to address the costs, the timing in terms of the economic cycle, or the benefits of the measure in terms of the economic costs. And so, you know, we felt that we were beginning to show the economic case was key for this group of policies. So that told us something about the UK, but did it travel? Well, first of all, we looked with a colleague, with colleagues Sandra Ruiz-Odagio and Isabel Engeli from the Dutch and Swiss agendas teams at four countries at these costly policies, ones aimed at labour market reforms. And we found this time a statistically significant link with the state of the economy. But then would it travel when we looked at a broader range of gender equality policies? Because the ones I've been talking about are only one type of issue. So we then looked with Isabel at the full range of equality policies, and we described them in three different ways. Class-based issues, the costly and redistributive ones that look at pension reform, childcare, parental leave. Status policies, which address women's status as women. So equal representation, reproductive rights, domestic violence, which may not be as costly to government but may face resistance, say, from religious groups. And then finally, blueprint policies, ones overarching statements of an intent to pursue gender equality, sort of symbolic. And our argument was that all three address the unequal status of men and women, but each will attract different interests and types of advocacy, and that in pursuing them, advocates will face different friction in the system and different veto points. So we looked at a much broader range of countries, and more broader occasions when these types of policies had reached the equivalent of the Queen's speeches and different agendas, and our findings were the economy mattered, but costly and redistributive policies, that women and kids were also important to getting these class redistributive policies on the agenda. Leftish parties mattered for getting labour and pension reform on the agenda, but didn't seem to be linked to childcare in the same way. And having women in the executive, in government, was important for getting the blueprint and the status policies on the agenda. So we felt we were showing that different issues were treated differently in terms of advocacy and friction. So that was our findings. Do they stack up? We're so pleased to have Kate and Patrick here to be able to say to them, tell us what it's really like to try and get government attention for gender equality. And the three questions that I've thrown into the pot is, do you see a difference in the type of policy issue in terms of how to advocate for change? How important is economic argumentation? And what strategies do feminist advocates follow if it's true that you, it's hard to get costly measures on the agenda when times are hard. So, shall I hand over to you, Kate?
Great. Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. I want to apologise. I am going to have to run off very sharply at 1 o'clock, but I'll try to be here for as much of the discussion as I possibly can. It's really interesting, actually, the findings that Francesca has just presented. And if I've been thinking about or knowing about what you were going to say, Francesca, I could have perhaps been even more thoughtful in the way in which I'll talk about some of the things that I'm going to talk about today. There's no doubt in my mind that the issues that Francesca has picked out do have a real bearing on progressive gender progressive policies. And you can see that in the economic context, when women are needed in the labour market, we get more programmes to promote their participation in the labour market. You can see it when women are represented at the highest echelons in public life, that we get more pro-female policy making. But I think it's also important to understand that the picture is quite complicated and variated. And there's not a dead simple linear approach that tells you when particular policies might stick or might not. And the reason for that, I think, is not least because of party politics and the fact that the two main parties in this country inhabit very, very different political ethoses, which actually in some ways shapes and overrides the way in which they actually think specifically about gender. And I think you can see that really clearly with the present government, which, despite the fact that it's got probably more Tory women MPs than I think it's ever had before, still not as many proportionately in the Tory party as we've got in the Labour party, but nonetheless they have made a significant step change in terms of female representation in Westminster in this parliament, despite the presence of those Tory women, very impressive women, many of them. We have a whole raft of policies coming out of this government which are absolutely inimical to women's interests and rights. Whether that's the benefits cuts, which have hit women, as we know, much harder than men, actually specifically removing or reducing benefits that are dedicatedly for women, like child benefit, which mostly goes to women, or some of the baby tax credits and maternity grants, whether it's the design of a new benefit, the universal credit, which will actually seriously compromise women's financial independence, not least because it's going to pay all the money to one person in the partnership, and that's quite likely to be the bloke, whether it's the way in which public sector cuts have impacted on women, both in terms of loss of services, which women disproportionately rely on, either for themselves or as the mediators of family access to public services, whether it's as a result of loss of jobs in the public sector. The government's very fond of telling us that these job losses in the public sector are being compensated for by new jobs in the private sector, but those jobs in the private sector are not as good, the rights are weaker, the pay is less generous, the security of those jobs is much less, and it is women who will pay the price as a result, or whether it's the attack on employee rights, the Beecroft proposals, the so-called red tape challenge, which seems to equate gender equality with sort of administrative inconvenience, as we saw very clearly when Vince Cable described some of the changes he's bringing forward at the moment as simply legislative tidying up. But I wouldn't say the Tory women achieved nothing in terms of reshaping where the Conservative Party is focusing its attention, and they are picking out issues that work for their own political ethos and putting them through a gender lens. So that, for example, their interest in sexual exploitation and the portrayal of women, or their interest on women on boards, or some of the things that they've begun to say about domestic and sexual violence and abuse, show that they're willing to pick up certain gender issues, but only, I would suggest, if they suit a broader partisan, philosophy-led political context. And there's a real lack of willingness, therefore, to engage with gender issues that don't fit with that particular party ethos. And indeed, they'll be very, very resistant to attempts to introduce structural policy measures that would actually get at some of the drivers, socioeconomic drivers of gender inequality, as I would see them. Now, what can make a difference? I'd say several things can make a difference. One is mouthy women on the left, And, you know, as for example, I think without Harriet Harman, we probably wouldn't have made any of the strides that we did in not just in being a mouthy woman, but actually opening up the space for many, many more women in Labour to be elected to Parliament, and the impact that that has had on our party's policies over the last decade and a half. But also, I would say, very importantly, not just for gender, but for all equalities groups, setting up, establishing an infrastructure to promote and support and develop equality policies has been really, really important in keeping the issue live in policy development. That doesn't mean it's visible always, it doesn't mean that it's high profile and sexy and exciting, but it actually compels a process of gender-proofing and gender-advancing. And it is that infrastructure, too, that this government is now putting under threat. So, Patrick may say something about this, too, whether it's the undermining of independent women-led NGOs and women's sector organisations, women's sector going through a very, very difficult period now. Many women's organisations having to pull out of the policy development landscape altogether because of lack of resource. The loss of the Women's National Commission, which was an independent in a position to advise government with great authority, dismantled very early act of the present coalition government. Whether it's the dismantling of some of the equality duties, so that the duty to promote equality now being removed in the present enterprise and regulatory reform bill. We're awaiting a consultation on the public sector equality duty with some alarm. And of course, another early act of the coalition government was to scrap the socioeconomic equality duty. And that's coupled with a serious weakening of the capacity and resource of the Equality and Human Rights Commission and of its independence, because the new framework agreement that it will have to have with the Government Equalities Office is actually quite specific in saying that the EHRC is there to promote the government's equalities agenda, which doesn't exactly speak to its independence. So I think for Labour now, one of the things that we have to be thinking about, as well as the individual policy areas and what we might want to be saying a Labour government would do to unwrap and make good some of the damage that has been done through the financial and benefits cuts, through public spending cuts, through the way in which policies have borne down particularly harshly on women. I think we also have to ask ourselves, how could we reconstruct an equalities architecture? And one that would actually survive this time, because I think it's an open secret that we didn't construct everything right the last time. You know, there are still person remarks about, did we get the right sort of single equalities body? And what might we do in future really to embed an infrastructure that is absolutely rock solid and much, much more difficult to dismantle. And the final thing I'd like to say is, just Francesca, which I wasn't going to say, but you've asked us three questions, so I will pick up the other one about economic context. And I think there's a really important argument for Labour progressives to start to think about in terms of how an equal recovery would actually be a stronger, a more resilient, and a more sustained economy recovery, and to challenge this assumption that promoting equal economic participation is somehow costly and bad news for the wider economic context. Because actually what we know at the moment is that women and other equalities groups are significantly underemployed in the labour market that we have at the moment. Underemployed because of occupational segregation, underemployed because still very, very difficult to access affordable and flexible childcare, underemployed because of, frankly, employer discrimination and expectation. And unless we challenge this economic orthodoxy, we are actually not going to make full use of the contribution that everybody could make to our economy through their labour market participation. And so I think there's some really sophisticated economic thinking that feminist economists need to help us with to show why an equal recovery is actually the best kind of recovery of all.
Fantastic, thank you. Kate, I have questions as a follow-up, but I'm going to pass straight over to Patrick.
Okay, well, thanks very much indeed, and it's great to be here. And I mean, you know, I think the work that Claire and Francesca have been doing in this area is, you know, is fantastic. And I've been wrestling with their research paper for a few days now, which is not a reflection on the clarity of their research paper, but more of my own intellectual inadequacies trying to understand the arguments, but I think that the case which is made there about the relationship between economic determinants and gender equality policies and looking at that in a more comparative context is absolutely fantastic work. I was just going to try to address four issues in relation to this question about when demands for gender equality get government attention. I want to just talk briefly about politics, then I want to say something about the economy, and then I'll turn briefly to the role of actors, and then finally I want to say something about institutions. I'm going to try and say about a minute and a half on each of those, so apologies for lack of clarity, or I can develop these points in the discussion afterwards. Just on the politics, I think it is important to say that, I mean, one of the reasons why gender equality received government attention from the New Labour government was that certainly prior to 1997, gender equality had been an important aspect of New Labour's political modernisation process. I think there are two dimensions of this to focus on. One is the recognition within the Labour Party prior to 1997 that it needed to secure more women's votes if it was going to reverse the pattern of electoral defeat, which had led to four defeats in the 1980s. And indeed, to address the fact that during the 1980s, women had been more likely to support the Conservative Party. And this had been an electoral truth that Labour needed to come to terms with. And so, in some sense, addressing issues that may be regarded as of significance to women was part of the electoral modernisation process. I think the other factor that's perhaps a bit downplayed as well is that gender equality was seen as integral to the modernisation process of Labour itself, in the sense of rejecting this kind of notion of Labour as an old-fashioned, class-based, some would argue patriarchal political party, and beginning to address issues of gender equality as a kind of mark of political modernisation in its own right. And there is an extraordinary speech in 1994 given by Gordon Brown, which is, I think, quoted in David Coates' chapter of your edited book, in which Gordon Brown has this quote where he talks about casting off the shackles of patriarchy, which is not a language I think he carried into government, but nonetheless, it kind of alludes to where Labour was at that particular point in the kind of in the modernisation process. So I think that's just to emphasise, really, that if a government comes to power with a kind of predisposition towards taking gender equality seriously, then that is more likely, I think, to produce conditions in which demands for gender equality will receive greater attention. But of course, the story about what happens post-1997, as Kate has really well underlined, is a much more complex one. Just to say a few words about the economy. I mean, as the papers argue brilliantly, economic determinants do make a decisive difference. I think it's true to say that at the outset of the Labour government, when the economic conditions were more benign, there was a greater complementarity between economic and social policy and the need to pursue particular kinds of gender equality policies. One strand of the argument which New Labour made frequently was this idea that economic efficiency and social justice are not opposites but go hand in hand. And in trying to make that case, there was this suggestion that you didn't have to choose between growth and policies that would enhance certain forms of equality. The two could be kind of mutually reinforcing. Now, I think we know subsequently that the story is a lot more complex than that, but it was an important argument in relation to the economy which was being made at that time. I think it's also true to say that in conditions where the economy is growing and where economic circumstances are relatively benign, it was easier for Labour ministers to make the case to organisations like the CBI that these measures would not cause grievous harm to economic competitiveness, to the so-called pro-friendly business position which New Labour at that time was adopting. And I should say, I'm not, in a sense, advocating that these strategies were necessarily the right ones. I think in the context of the economic crisis, we can see their obvious limitations, but that nonetheless was the case that was being made. The other aspect of this was the notion that, again, integral to New Labour's economic and social policy was the centrality of paid work, and in particular in relation to the reforms that were instigated in relation to the welfare state, there was this very strong notion that paid work was everything. Employability, labour market participation, accessing the employment market were the kind of key to the modernisation of the welfare state, but also to poverty alleviation. Now, as Kate is far better placed than me to argue, this is a somewhat limited strategy because paid work actually isn't the only route out of poverty. And of course, feminists have been quite right to raise a set of issues about the question of the relationship between paid and unpaid work, labour which is performed within the labour market and labour which is performed within the household, which was completely missing really from most of that discourse. And then, of course, just a final point on the economy. When the economy is growing, That means that tax revenues are growing, so the scope available to redistribute public expenditure is greater, and therefore it is possible to spend on particular social programmes that might be seen to contribute towards gender equality goals. So benign economic context, I think, does make a difference, as the paper argues, and I think you can't get away from that. Just a couple of final points on actors and institutions. As has been said already, actors do make a decisive difference, and certainly my experience of working both in government and in the Equalities Commission is that actors at particular points make a crucial difference. As Kate has already underlined, having a group of effective women ministers within the core executive does at crucial junctures make a decisive difference towards the adoption of certain policies. I think Harriet Harman, as you rightly said, made a huge contribution. Patricia Hewitt, particularly when she was Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, dealing very directly with issues of business competitiveness. Going back a bit further, ministers like Margaret Jay, Barbara Roach, of course, who was responsible for the initial establishment of the Equalities Commission. These ministers made a number of important differences as actors. As I said, they helped to reinforce some of the commitments which had been made. They reminded a predominantly male cabinet that Labour had made commitments in opposition that it needed to stick to when it was in government. So I think the role of ministers is very, very important. Another aspect of this in relation to the role of ministers, which I thought I should just briefly mention, I think it's important not to underplay the significance of the competition within the core executive between Tony Blair and Gordon Brown when Blair was Prime Minister and Brown was Chancellor of the Exchequer. And that's not to say that they were having a daily wrangle about who was more egalitarian on gender issues, but I think it is true to say that there was some competition within the core executive about which office could be seen to be pushing a progressive agenda more effectively. I think that did make a difference in some areas. I remember, as Kate will, in 1999, Tony Blair made a speech in which he committed Labour to abolish child poverty by 2020. No doubt a commitment and a set of policies that would make a decisive difference, both to children but also to many women. And Blair made that announcement without any consultation with the Treasury. And he did that because he didn't want Brown to steal his announcement. So there's a kind of strange dynamic around intra-core executive competition, which I think we shouldn't ignore in all of this, but happy to say a bit more about that. Role of special advisers is also critical. I work very closely with Carrie Oppenheim, who was the special adviser in the Prime Minister's policy unit. She was able, by having that quite high-profile position within the core executive, to push policies both at the centre and into departments. Also, Maeve Sherlock, who was one of the advisers in the Council of Economic Advisers in the Treasury, made a critical difference. And finally, we shouldn't ignore the role of women officials. Helen Ghosh yesterday made this rather striking set of observations about the dominance of Etonians in the Cameron government. But I mean, Helen Ghosh is part of a generation of female officials coming into the civil service, and it now appears that the progress is being reversed, but no doubt did make a big contribution to these policies. Let me just say a final word on institutions. I think that we have to obviously think about the role of institutions, particularly with regard not just to what worked under New Labour, but also in regards to what didn't work. And obviously the story of policy success is very mixed. And I think institutions did make a big difference here. One issue was about the structure of the economy. Labour was attempting to create a set of institutions within a predominantly neoliberal pro-business framework. That raises lots of issues, limitations, and other issues that we could talk about. I think a second issue which is critical is about the lack of institutional capacity and the lack of governance capacity within particular institutions. Kate has quite rightly mentioned the Equalities Commission. Although the government made significant strides by setting up the commission, I think it didn't think through many of the issues about how the commission could be a powerful enforcer of rights and of particular claims on behalf of particular groups. As has been said, its independent relationship with government was constantly threatened. There was a lack of clarity around its powers, and these were issues that have to be looked at. The other point I think to make clear is that also many public sector institutions which the EHRC was overseeing and policing were themselves deeply reluctant to make a proper commitment to the proper following through of gender equality policies and the claims that go alongside them, such that the Commission was constantly having to investigate why particular public sector institutions hadn't followed the gender equality duty. For a relatively small commission, this was, I think it's fair to say, a pretty impossible task. And of course, this was underlined just after the election when the Treasury failed to carry out an equality impact assessment on the public spending decisions which were being made in the context of the austerity agenda. And if the Treasury is doing that as a kind of exemplar institution at the centre of government, I think that kind of underlines the sort of reluctance within the public sector. I should just say that I am now a local councillor, and I sit on the Social Care Committee in the council where I'm elected, and we face a constant battle to enforce gender equality and other equality duties on public sector organisations. The view within the health and social care sector is that these are things which can basically be ignored, and equality impact assessments are things which are done by very junior officials which senior management never take seriously. So I think there's a huge sort of set of issues there about the capacity of institutions. And then the other point that falls out of that is obviously Whitehall itself. You know, Whitehall remains substantially unreformed. There is some evidence that some parts of the senior civil service have become a bit more diverse in the last 10 or 15 years. The truth is the picture is still one of huge imbalances, gender imbalances, ethnic minority imbalances, but also class imbalances, and this is an issue which has not really gone away. So that's just a word on each of those issues. I'll say no more and obviously open up for discussion. I would just underline that I've talked about politics, I've talked about the role of actors, I've talked about the economy, and I've talked about institutions. I mean, as I said in relation to the Blair Brown point, I think we should also perhaps take into account the extent to which contingency also matters, and actually it's amazing when you look back at particular policies how some of them, some gender equality policies were achieved basically by accident due to a particular constellation of events. And I was reminded by, I think when you're perhaps studying core executive politics, you should never forget the importance of speeches. Speeches play a huge role in terms of the rhythm, particularly of the new Labour government. And every party conference speech every year, when both Gordon Brown and Tony Blair were preparing their speeches, there was a constant sort of battle among the different advisers to try and force particular measures into those speeches. Now, that has an advantage and a disadvantage. The advantage is you can, if you're lucky, get ambitious gender equality speeches into either the Prime Minister or the Chancellor's speech, which makes it more likely that they will happen. The downside is it tends to lead to initiatives and policies which are actually extremely poorly thought through. And I'm happy to talk about some of those if that's helpful. Thanks.
Wow, fantastic. Kate and Patrick, thank you so much for those really great great comments. Like I said, I have questions, but I'm going to hold fire and open up to the floor, as I'm sure there's going to be questions or comments or insights or reflections that you might want to make. Yeah.
I think there's probably two things that I'm most interested in. To what extent is there a bigger issue about inequality generally that needs to be addressed? And second of all, this is probably to Kate, to what extent do you feel that Labour at the moment is really pushing for gender equality policies?
Do you want to take several there? Or?
Yeah, should we take a few questions and then we'll get some responses.
Well, we've got all two of those.
Yeah. Any more questions?
You've got them.
Okay, well, I think I had a question that links into, I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Roz,
and that links into Roz's question, which is, given the state of the economy, how different would things be if we had a Labour government now? I mean, what guarantees could you produce, not guarantees, but what suggestions would you have for strategy? What strategies would you develop to promote gender equality issues in times of austerity when the economy is going belly up? And I guess the flip side of that is, I think Patrick alluded to some of this. Had the economic situation been different under New Labour, I think the opportunities for getting some of these issues into speeches, onto the agenda, would have been much tighter. But let's start with that as the first couple of questions. Well, how does this link to inequality more generally? And then you link that on to the issue of New Labour. What's New Labour doing now? Is it doing enough? And if it was in government, what strategies would it have to be? And maybe Patrick, maybe you can say what would you recommend as a former advisor.
Okay. Yeah. I I think we shouldn't be frightened of the economic context. I think we should start to think about how we make the economic context a positive for gender equality, and how we go back to that old, but in my view, perfectly sound Labour idea of full employment. Now, that does create issues about unpaid work, which we certainly need to think about. But it seems to me that there would be no reason not to return to that ambition of full employment and to think about what that actually means in terms of engaging the right degree of labour market participation of women as well as men, and other equalities groups who are very, very underrepresented in the labour market too. And I think one of the reasons why we know that actually makes some economic sense is because if you look at the improvement in family living standards, family incomes over the last several decades, it has been women's joining of the labour market that has actually improved family living standards. That's what's accounted for the growth in family income. So there's some very sound arguments about the economic contribution that women make. And so I think if you were saying what would Labour be doing different, we would be thinking about that. You know, what are the economic strategies that will actually draw more women into the labour market and support them to thrive and progress there? Our interest in investing in infrastructure, I think, offers significant potential to think that infrastructure isn't just things that you might associate with blokes, like roads and nuclear energy or whatever. I mean, as we say, women can't be nuclear scientists, and we have a real issue about gender segregation, but infrastructure investment in childcare, for example, would be a very pro-female economic growth investment. And in fact, Chris Leslie specifically tabled an amendment just the other day to the government's infrastructure bill making this suggestion. But I must tell you that the origin of the suggestion is the Women's Budget Group, because it was first raised there by, I think, Sue Himmelwhite, and it was passed on from Sue through me to Chris, and I'm very pleased that, you know, he picked it up very enthusiastically. So I think we could look for opportunities to reshape our economy that would facilitate women's labour market participation and facilitate other things that are actually good for women too. Employment rights would be another one to look at. I think the question is, of our Labour doing enough to push gender equality now is interesting, because I think we're perhaps not doing it enough in that economic context. I think we've done a tremendous job. Yvette Cooper has done an absolutely stellar job, I think, of exposing very, very quickly the disproportionate impact of the coalition government's fiscal policies. And there's no doubt that we will want to go on exposing that. You know, it's a good line of attack for us. It's also true that we've begun to identify groups of women who are being completely missed by public policy. One group we're very interested in, and it's what we call older women, by which we don't mean older women, because we mean women of my age, women in their 50s and 60s, who are actually quite significant economic actors. They're probably caring for the grandkids, looking after their elderly mom, they're still working, they're worrying about their own pension, they're now being told they're probably going to have to work till they're 72 anyway, and there's going to be no social care for them when they are old. So I think that attention to groups of women who have been completely missed would be something that Labour... We did it well with younger women, with women bringing up young families in the Blair and Brown governments. Huge amount of investment poured into those families, rewarded at the ballot box. You know, more, as Patrick said, women didn't used to vote for us. That group of women now do, but older women don't, because we haven't yet done very much for them. So I think there's electoral advantage to us in looking at this group too. And then I do think that we should be thinking ahead to the next generation, and there really are opportunities for us to be talking about what is it that is going wrong really very, very early on that predisposes girls down a route where they actually do very well academically now, and then they still end up in the jobs and the industry sectors that are less well-paid with less good progression opportunities. And there's some work going on by an academic whose name I've forgotten at King's College, which is actually suggesting that this begins very, very early on in the way that you shape, how girls perceive their role well before they're in secondary school. You know, the coalition government's very keen that it should be done in our wonderful secondary academies and preschools, but actually it needs to start much, much earlier. You know, beginning as girls are considering what subjects to study for GCSE is actually way too late.
Great, Kevin. Patrick.
Yeah, I'll just be very quick. I mean, Ros's point about inequality is obviously sort of critical in all of this. And one of the strategies that the previous government tried to follow was to develop this notion of a socioeconomic duty that would kind of sit sort of alongside but also above the existing equality duties. Obviously that, as Kate alluded to earlier, is going to be, I think, reversed by the present government. So that is not going to be available in future years. But it certainly is a real issue. And I think one of the issues that the previous government didn't think through was how these kind of notional equality duties in relation to different groups would fit into a kind of a broader architecture of economic and social policy. So you had this kind of rights-based approach operating in one sphere of the government, but in the other sphere you had attempts to try and develop different kinds of economic and social policies, and often those two didn't join up very successfully. But there's no question, if you look at the statistics, the differential impact of the Gini coefficient, that over the 13 years Labour was in power, it did make significant progress, as Kate said, among some groups, but clearly a number of different groups of women were left out of that picture of progress. And I was very struck the other day, there was this debate at the moment about whether you should take away benefits for older people, because people say, well, pensioners are doing relatively well in the current economic context, we should take away their winter fuel allowance, take away their travel pass and all the rest of it. And actually you see in the statistics that women over 60 have 56% of the income of men. So there's actually a huge sort of interface between gender and economic inequality. On the question that Claire raises about whether in less benign economic circumstances New Labour would have been able to follow through the policies, I mean, my view on this is that it wouldn't, because I think in the end, although it talked about the notion of the two going hand in hand, there's no question that economic efficiency trumped social justice. The Labour government was absolutely 100% committed to never getting on the wrong side of business. And on the wrong side of business, I mean particularly the CBI. And so I think if economic conditions had been tougher, then I think the new Labour government would have struggled to see down the opposition that was coming from those particular quarters, and therefore we would have seen less progress. It's probably not a terribly surprising conclusion, but that's what I think to be the case.
That's still true, Patrick, because we've got an Ed Miliband, a leader who is, at least in terms of the language he's using, and also in some of the policy areas that we're pushing on, a willingness to take a slightly different stance?
I think it isn't true now. And I mean, I'm talking very much about the, I guess, the period after 1997, but the whole period between 97 and 2010. I think post-2010, the context is quite different. There is a different attitude towards the role of business. There's a different attitude towards the role of corporations in the financial sector. Now, whether this will last or not is, I think, an important question, but I think the context has shifted a bit, and therefore I think an Ed Miliband government may treat these issues somewhat differently, but I think that would be true in respect to the Blair and Brown governments. And on Claire's final and very tough question about what should Labour do, I was just going to mention a couple of issues very briefly. One is about the devolution of economic power. Coming from the somewhat surprising quarters of Lord Heseltine this week, we have seen this quite interesting report about devolving more power to regional economies. Now, I mean, there's lots of ways in which that can go wrong, but I think it is an interesting sort of analysis about the degree of centralisation in Britain, the extent of regional economic inequalities. And I think if you were thinking about how you could bring gender into more regional and local economic regeneration strategies, that would be potentially quite an interesting avenue for policy. I'm not sure how much that has been looked at, but, I mean, again, it fits into the devolution agenda and the sorts of initiatives which are now being directed out of the Welsh Assembly and the Scottish Parliament, and also, what contribution local government can make to all of this. And then the other issue I was just going to raise very quickly is the importance of kind of Labour absorbing services in areas like social care and healthcare. These are going to become hugely important, both economically and socially. Economically as employers, and socially in terms of dealing with challenges around an ageing population and, of course, the ongoing requirements to have good childcare systems. At the moment, those sectors employ predominantly women. The childcare sector employs 97.6% women. The sectors are still hugely poorly paid and, of course, also substantially unregulated and suffer from weak investment in skills. So I think a Labour government needs to have a strategy about how it's going to increase productivity and wages in those sectors if it's going to address some of the more systemic causes of unequal gender pay.
Right. Thank you. We have a question from Georgina.
No comment, really.
Oh, comment.
I was just struck by what Kate said in terms of Yvette Cooper and the potential that ties into your question, really, Labour strategy for the future. Is actually maybe one way forward is this kind of almost not partly move away, but also additional perspective on top of the women as victims, which has been the big thing that, as you rightly said, Yvette Cooper have done very well about women being hardest hit by the recession. Maybe it is time for more emphasis on the role of women in coming out of austerity, and if you have an economic policy that isn't just about cuts, but is about, you know, more Keynesian kind of approach, about, as you said, getting women into the labour force, infrastructure spending, which has a sort of gendered impact, you'll talk about, you know, the social care sector, you can actually turn the argument around and say gender equality will actually, I mean, it's a bit like the World Bank talks about the business case for gender equality, that you can make quite a positive argument. And I think that the Resolution Foundation this week, in their report, they talk very much in those terms, certainly about, you know, the role of women in the labour market, raising living standards and the need for, you know, childcare of £1 an hour.
Any more questions? Okay, Francesca.
Well, this is just an observation that I'm testing out, really. You know, for me, the link between early feminist activity in labour in the 70s and 80s is what we saw coming through and informing a mindset which meant new labour was receptive to gender equality. Undoubtedly, and that kind of movement did coalesce around achieving equal representation in the party and beyond. And my sense now is that the issue of equal representation is really one that is engaging younger women, and that I see cropping up in terms of demands for quotas on boards and science, and. So I feel a sense of enthusiasm and hope about the fact that that kind of energising debate is happening again, and that will reboot us all in the future. And so I just wonder whether that's maybe overly optimistic.
I've certainly noticed. I mean, I'm a feminist of the 1970s. That's when I first became a feminist, as a very young woman. And I've never been ashamed to say it, but for a long time it became, I'm not a feminist, but, and by later on in my adult life, perhaps the 90s and the early part of this century, women rather moved away from feminism, especially young women. It was much more about my choice to do what I like. And you still hear these arguments made, it's my choice to be a lap dancer. I'm not sure that I think it really is. I'm economically independent. I can achieve what any man can achieve. And feminism became very much, a bit of a dirty word. People didn't want to associate themselves with it. I think that is changing. I detect more willingness for younger women to identify themselves as feminists. And if not to identify themselves as feminists, certainly to speak in conceptually of structural inequality as opposed to it being about what's happening in their personal life. So I certainly think there's something there for us to build on and to energise. It's very interesting at our own Labour Party Women's Conference, which happens at the beginning of our annual conference, so it took place in Manchester last month, how many of the women at that conference talked about representation. Actually, it was the single biggest issue in this open mic session where anyone can raise anything. The single biggest issue that came up was representation, not economy or public services or international issues, which actually, there was a lot to say about. But still, real concerns about underrepresentation, including, I have to say, in our own party. You know, we've got all women shortlists. It's amazing that we still need them, but we do, because we still, even though we have more women MPs in Westminster than all the other parties put together, there's still only a third of our parliamentary party that is female. At local government level, women struggle, certainly, to get into local council executives. It'd be interesting to know what's going on in your local authority, Patrick, but it was raised a lot. You know, at local government, it's still older men who hold the executive positions. The difficulty that women face in taking office in their own local Labour Party, you know, being the chair of the party or being able to actually shape what the party campaigns on locally, women still feel that's difficult and they've got to fight for it. So I certainly don't think that we've sorted out the representation issues, but I do think we've got a group of younger women who are very, very vocal again about the need for structural change, both organisational structural change and social structural change, and I find that very heartening.
I'm just going to add, I think as Kate says, I think that the you know, the image of the 78-year-old male Labour councillor, I mean, that's not going to go away anytime soon. It's a continuing feature of local governance, which yes, needs to be addressed. I was just going to make one comment about networks, because this is a point which again Helen Ghosh, who was the permanent secretary in several big government departments over the last 12 years, made this speech yesterday where she talked about the effect of having a very enclosed network around the Prime Minister in Number 10. And I think that we shouldn't underestimate the kind of the significance of all of this. And it's not just under the current Cameron government. I mean, under the previous government, under all administrations, certainly for the last 30 or 40 years, there have been very tight networks around the core executive. And I think this issue about who has the ability to access those networks and on what terms is a hugely important one. So while there may be grounds for optimism about representation, there's still real issues about who is accessing the power networks, who's taking the decisions, how are those power relationships working, and how does that then feed through into the policy process.
I must tell you, I sit in Parliament sometimes, and you know, it's like this, I'm sitting looking across all of them, and I sit there and I truly think to myself, what am I doing, a middle-aged woman in Eton College? Because that's what it looks like. It's rows and rows of prosperous young men.
I think this will be one last question. We'll get some responses, and then we're nearly at 1 o'clock, Kate, so we'll let you go.
We've been obviously very much talking about representation, but I'm actually just a little surprised that we haven't been talking much about the economy, the economic aspect, because I feel, as you pointed out before, women have benefited from, you know, better social rights and better equal pay, you know, at times of wealth, you know, or a good economic prosperity. So in the light of the economic European downturn, I'm not very keen on waiting for the economy to recover. So I was rather actually interested in knowing if there's any thinking about just rethinking the way we see work and we see wealth. I mean, women in this gendered, you know, division, traditional division, are just doing some works which work, a lot of work, which is just simply not valued in economic perspective. They are not integrated, they're underemployed because they are at home, or doing things which do not have they have a very strong community value, but not a monetary value. So I'm as a woman, you know, and Sonia of us, I'm not expecting the economy to absorb me, because even in this kind of the labour market to absorb me, even in an underemployment, you know, scheme. So I'm not waiting for that. Plus, you've been mentioning as well, you know, women go ultimately for jobs which are underpaid. I mean, it's just because of this, you know, path in which we are educated, we are drawn to branches of the economy which are less valued in monetary. So there's something about the education, and there's something about the economy not being able to absorb all this additional extra labour in terms of in an economic downturn context. So I'm not expecting, so to wrap it up, in this, I'm surprised we're not touching more upon like the economic aspect of this exclusion, basically, or this lack of inclusion.
It's kind of like, it's a bit like the social mobility debate, isn't it? For some people to be socially mobile upwards, others might have to be socially mobile downwards. And actually, one of the things I think we have to think about seriously is, are we sharing paid work and caring properly between women and men? And no, we're plainly not. Women are still doing more of the caring. There's a bit of a blip at the moment because of what's happening to male employment post the crash. But generally, you know, the typical male full-time breadwinner pattern and women doing some work to support that, which will be promoted, actually, by the government's universal credits, because that will positively encourage one breadwinner, probably the bloke, and a few hours from a second earner. Actually, that's completely wrong. If you want to give some proper value to the caring and community work that has done, and if you actually want to create a real equality of choice for women and for men, we should perhaps be not looking for what the present government seems to want, which is one and a bit workers, but 2-3-quarter workers in a 2-earner household. And that would both enable greater labour market choices for women and it would and greater choices outside the labour market for men, but it would also, I think, get some of the way to your point about actually putting some value on the work that isn't the paid work, but is all the other activity. If that was something that women and men were participating in more equally, there would be more, I think, of an impetus to recognise it.
I think on the question about transitioning to a model where formal labour market work and household labour are more equally shared, there is a notion among policymakers about what would be necessary to get there. But obviously what has been lacking is real commitment to putting the policies in place to ensure that it happens. I mean, if you look at issues around the availability of childcare, for example, then in some parts of the country it's still woefully inadequate and also very, very expensive. I mean, the UK has the most expensive childcare system among all the industrialised countries. And we also, I think, suffer in relation to inadequate arrangements for flexible working, which means that, as you rightly pointed out, many women are working significantly below their labour market potential, which then has an impact on gender equality. The broader question, though, I just wanted to raise very briefly was about the kind of post-crisis thinking about these issues. I think we've been talking today, obviously, about a period in which New Labour was governing in benign economic circumstances where the economic growth model was pretty much taken for granted. I think the broader question which the period after 2008-09 raises is whether we are going to need to undertake some quite radical refashioning of the economic paradigm. Now, I think at the moment you would say it looks like we're pretty much reverting to business as usual. But then if you think about previous economic periods, it took, you know, 10 or 15 years for governments in the 1930s to transition from the Great Depression to the kinds of Keynesian revolution of the post-war period. So it may be that it takes longer, and it may be that at the core of that new paradigm there is a much stronger recognition about some of the limitations of economic growth, the need to take different kinds of work more seriously, the pressures imposed by overconsumption and environmental constraints. So I don't think that we should be necessarily completely pessimistic, but I think there's a long way to go in transitioning from one paradigm to another.
Fantastic. Kate, I'm conscious that you have to go. We have one more comment.
Kind of half question, half comment, really. But I'm just thinking that in terms of a reminder of how vulnerable men in gender equality are. But have we almost recession proof then? Mm-hmm. Have we stopped using the recession as an excuse? I think that's what it is, really. The recession should not be an acceptable excuse. We need to remove recession proof.
I think that's probably a great point for us to finish. And I'm very conscious that Kate has to go at 1 o'clock. So, Laura, thank you. We can have that as our thought to go away with. How do we recession-proof Gaines for Let me just finish by thanking Kate and Patrick very much for coming and contributing to this discussion. Thank you to you all for coming along as well. And thank you, Francesca, as well, for presenting the research at the start. So that's the end of our session. I think we can press stop on the podcast now.